So today I'd like to discuss the current structure of the bond market in Australia and talk about some of the trends that I think might influence its evolution over the next few years. I'll focus mainly on the bank debt and the Kanga market, given that's probably what you're interested in. But I'll also talk about something else that a few people in the room are probably interested in, which is some issues surrounding the implementation of the Basel liquidity standard. So to set the scene, and stuff you're probably all well aware of, but relative to the size of the Australian economy, the Australian bond market is about average for developed economies. But unlike in many countries around the world today, the private debt market is significantly larger than the public market. So if I showed this graph of pretty much any other country in the world, the government bar would be large and getting a hell of a lot larger. So the size of the government bond market here reflects the prudential fiscal policy pursued by both sides of politics at the federal and state level over an extended period of time. But of more interest, perhaps, to this audience is the non-government debt market, which consists of four main categories of issuers. Financial institutions, which is the yellow bar, the yellow line at the top, other corporate issuers, asset-backed issuers, and non-resident or Kanga issuers. So as can be seen in this graph, while all four segments of the market have grown over the past couple of decades, the development of the market has not been uniform. So financial institutions have for some time had the largest share of issuance. As you can see, the orange line, asset-backed issuance, grew rapidly during the early 2000s, but its growth was most severely affected by the financial crisis. Corporate issuance has grown steadily over the past two decades, and more recently, strong demand for Aussie dollar assets has seen rapid issuance of Australian dollar debt by non-residents, the Kanga market. So I'd like to touch briefly on the main drivers of developments in each of these markets and talk about some of the factors, potential factors affecting future issuance. So looking first at financials, over the much of the past couple of decades, demand for credit outpaced the growth in deposits. So this line here is just credit by the banking sector, and the purple line is growth in deposits. So you can see there the light blue line lies above the purple line for much of the past couple of decades up until recently. So banks accessed wholesale funding markets to support growth in lending, so i.e. to fill that gap between credit and deposits. And that outcome reflected a number of factors. So Australia's relatively high level of investment and the sustained growth momentum of the economy over the past two decades underpin the demand for credit. So while the source of demand shifted between households and businesses, from the early 1990s recovery until the financial crisis, aggregate credit growth was sustained at a rate of above 10% per annum. At the same time, on the supply side, the importance of superannuation in Australia has, for much of the past few decades, constrained the growth in household deposits. So super funds have historically tended to invest in wholesale bank paper rather than whole bank deposits. So compared with other countries, more of the savings of the Australian household sector has tended to end up in wholesale bank paper rather than in deposits, with the super scheme or super sector as the intermediary. More recently, however, the demand for credit from households and businesses has slowed in tandem. So you can see that slowdown in the light blue line. For businesses, the reduced appetite for debt was initially due to a desire to strengthen balance sheets in the early stages of the financial crisis. But more recently, strong profitability, most obviously in the mining sector, is ensuring many segments of the business sector have sufficient internal funding to meet their investment needs without resorting to borrowing through the banking sector. As has been discussed in much recent RBA commentary, on the household side, the slowing in demand for credit appears to be driven by a more cautious approach to debt, and there are a number of factors contributing to this. One is that the increase in household leverage that occurred through the 1990s and first half of the 2000s in response to the downward shift in the nominal structure of interest rates has probably largely run its course. The slower growth in household wealth, and particularly the large negative shock to equity at the height of the crisis, has also contributed to the cautiousness. So this growing caution of households in the past few years has seen the household saving rate pick up substantially, and much of that saving has been in the form of deposits, given the attractive yields on offer. And that's most obviously you can see that in the self-managed super sector. The strong cash position of many businesses is also contributing to stronger deposit growth. So as a result of these factors, as you can see here, in the last couple of years, deposit growth has outstripped credit growth quite substantially. So banks have experienced a slowdown in asset growth and have funded the assets with a greater share of deposits. So So as a result of that, the structure of banks' financing has changed quite significantly over the last few years. So wholesale debt issuance has declined to its slowest pace since the mid-1990s, particularly in short-term issuance. So you can see here the red line. This is the overall funding of the Australian banking sector. Short-term debt issuance has fallen by 10 percentage points, which is a pretty large shift in a share. And you can see that large rise in the share of funding from deposits, a gradual decline in securitisation as well. At the same time, banks have obviously sought to lengthen the average maturity of their funding by increasing the share of long-term debt in their total funding. Now, I think there are reasonable grounds to expect these trends may be sustained for some time to come. In particular, if you think about the composition of growth in Australia in the period ahead, it is likely to be investment intensive, and that's certainly embodied in our forecast. But much of that investment is likely to be funded by companies which are cash rich or tap global markets directly. So this means that the growth in the economy in the period ahead should be associated with less growth in business credit than has been the case in the past. At the same time, that's also likely to continue to boost deposit growth. So I think this trend that we've seen in the banking sector over the last few years may continue for a while, where they have a period of faster deposit growth but slower asset growth. And so I'd say this structure of the bank's balance sheets is, if anything, going to continue to evolve in the fashion it has over the last couple of years. So let me now turn to the asset-backed market. Oh, hang on. There we go. So the graph here just shows the stock of Australian RMBS outstanding. So it's not all asset-backed issuance, but the bulk of it is in RMBS. And the blue part is the part which is issued onshore. Doesn't mean it's held by onshore investors, just the part which is actually issued onshore. The light green part is the part which is actually issued directly offshore, of which there's been none for the last 4 years now. And the yellow part is the part which is the OFM's, is the share of the issuance that the OFM's bought. So if you see in the period up to 2007, during the period of an expansion in household balance sheets, an increasingly significant source of funding financial institutions was the RMBS market. But as you all know, structured credit products were the major casualty of the financial crisis, even in Australia, where they continued to perform well. So as a result, their share of the market has declined sharply over the past 3 years. Now, I spoke at length about the challenges facing the securitisation market only a couple of months ago, so I'll just reiterate some of the key points here. So firstly, Australian mortgage-backed securities have performed well throughout the crisis, with no investor losing any money in a rated tranche. The fundamental quality of the local collateral here suggests that securitisation ought to be a viable funding mechanism in Australia going forward. But I don't think it's going to return to the level seen in the pre-crisis period, given that some of the purchasers of the paper pre-crisis are no longer around, most obviously the CIVs, who bought a large chunk, particularly of that light green issuance on the graph there. But the recent issue by one of the major banks demonstrated demand is improving for the product. They issued it at a price which was inside the recent AOFM-supported deals, and there was a fair amount of excess demand out there as well. At the same time, on the asset-backed side, the government has obviously recently announced it will permit the issuance of covered bonds. So it'll be interesting to see where this product fits in with the existing RMBS. I suspect there may be different preferences between the local buyers, who are more familiar with RMBS, and the offshore buyers, most obviously in Europe, who are more familiar with covered issuance. I'm going to skip over talking about the corporate sector, but there's a little bit more about that in the written version of this talk. And instead, I'll move on and talk about the market which you guys are most familiar with, which is the Kanga market. So the fastest growing segment of the Australian capital market over much of the past decade, and certainly in recent months, has been Australian dollar issuance by non-residents. Initially, much of the issuance was offshore in the euro bond market, but increasingly issuance has moved to the onshore kangaroo market. So you can see in the most recent period of time, basically all the issuance has been in kangas, and the share of euro bonds has declined accordingly. So in addition to the shift in the location of market activity, over the last few years, an important compositional shift is occurring, with new issuance increasingly denominated by AAA-rated names. So what we've got here is the flow of new issuance and the maturities, and the blue bit is the AA issuance, and the red bit is the non-AA issuance. And you can see most of the issuance has been increasingly share of the issuance in AAA, and more and the low AAA issuance hasn't kept pace with maturities. The red bar at the end there is the JP Morgan issuance last week. So there is still non-AAA issuance actually occurring, just a bit less of it. So the growth in the AAA segment of the market has been underpinned by rapid growth in issuance among the supras and sovereign agencies. So SSA issuance in all currencies has grown rapidly in recent years, not just in Aussie dollars, as these borrowers have responded to the large fiscal demands stemming from the impact of the global recession on public budgets in a range of jurisdictions. In addition, SSA issuers have displayed a growing tendency to issue in Australian dollars over recent years. So we've got here, this is the Aussie dollar share of total or global super issuance over the last couple of decades, and you can see that rising, that share rising, particularly through the early part of last decade and again recently. So last year, Aussie dollar issuance accounted for more than 8% of global SSA issuance in all currencies. So the greater tendency to issue in Aussie dollars has been driven by both demand and cost considerations for the issuers. On the demand side, it is clear, although we don't really have hard data to show it, that global demand for high-yielding Aussie dollar assets has been growing in recent years. And one part of that is a group of international investors potentially in the official sector, along with the domestic investor base, who are interested in purchasing higher quality Aussie dollar assets. And as I showed right at the beginning, given there's not much government, high-quality government paper around in this market, this has created the natural opportunity for SSA issuers. Moreover, as you're probably all aware, there's tending to be a cost advantage to issuing in Aussie, owing in part to elevated cross-currency basis swap that has encouraged that issuance. Equally important as the cost of hedging is the large amount of foreign issuance by Australian entities that ensures access to a deep swap market for SSA's funding in Aussie dollars. So let me just finish off with talking a little bit about the recent APRA liquidity announcement and try and clear up some misconceptions which I think are out there about it. So the APRA announcement, which is about the forthcoming Basel liquidity standards, which take effect in 2015, it stated that CGS and semis are the only assets that qualify as Level 1 assets and that there are currently no Level 2 assets on issue in Australia. This outcome reflected an assessment of the liquidity characteristics of the various asset classes that might potentially qualify. So as outlined in the Basel documents, key considerations in determining which assets qualify are assessments of the depth of local trading activity and the performance of assets in stress market conditions. Now, we've actually had a period of stress market conditions in the not-too-distant past, so that gave us something to work with. So specifically, the observed performance of assets during the crisis, a period indicative of a situation in which banks actually need to rely on liquidity in these instruments. So this liquidity regime is in there so that banks are more able to rely on that source of funding or that source of liquidity in a crisis. It's not just there for window dressing. It was taken as evidence of... So what we looked at was the performance of these assets during the crisis to get some evidence of proven liquidity. So the APRA statement did not rule out other assets qualifying as liquid assets at a later date, but there will need to be some history to support an assessment that a particular market has genuine liquidity. So as is widely understood, in Australia, the amount of CGS and semis on issue falls well short of the amount of liquid assets banks will need to hold to meet the Basel liquidity standard. Moreover, it would be counterproductive to require banks to hold such a large share of these assets that it would impair the liquidity in these markets. Basically, it would be self-defeating if the banks bought up all the CGS and semis and the market was no longer liquid to meet something which is supposed to be a liquidity rule. Hence, as announced in December by us and APRA, the RBA will offer the banks a committed liquidity facility to meet the shortfall. So the eligible assets the banks will need to hold to access the facility with the RBA are those assets which are currently eligible for repo with us in our normal operations. So while a fee will be charged for this facility, I don't see that affecting the relative demand for securities for the following reason. So you can think of what's going on at the moment, so before the new liquidity regime takes effect, as an arrangement where a flat rate of zero is charged for the banks to access our liquidity. So banks currently hold a range of assets to satisfy their liquidity requirements today, with each asset having different credit, maturity and market liquidity characteristics, our view of how much we are willing to lend against each asset under repo is based on those characteristics, and that will continue to be the case going forward. So the current regime is one where we effectively have a flat fee of zero. In the future, we are moving to a world where there will be a formalised liquidity facility where a flat positive fee is charged. And the key word here is flat. So that should affect all asset classes equally and should not affect their relative attractiveness. So I would not expect this to change bank balance sheets' demand for the non-government assets they hold in their liquidity portfolios. To the extent that they hold SSAs today, which they do, then they're going to hold them, I would expect, in the future. The flat fee I don't see affecting the relative demand for banks' liquids. So I'm happy to take more questions after that. I'm sure you probably have got a few questions about that afterwards. But the main point to get across is there is not the banks are only going to be able to meet a very small share of their liquidity requirements through holding CGS and semis. They will still have to hold a large liquidity book, which by and large is going to look pretty much the same as the liquidity book looks today. And as I said, to the extent that they hold supras today, they're going to probably hold supras in the future. So let me finish and just go over briefly what I've talked about today, which is basically to describe the configuration of the bond market as it stands in early 2011. But the structure of the market has changed noticeably after the events of recent years. So some of the dynamics that have emerged from the crisis may continue to shape the bond market in the future, and I've highlighted three here today. So firstly, the relative growth of deposits and credit may be quite different from that observed over the previous 15 years. So this, together with regulatory and other pressures, will have a material effect on the composition of bank liabilities. You're likely to see the share of short-term bank funding remain at a relatively low level, the banks continuing to term out and increase their share of wholesale funding, and deposits continuing to be an increasingly large share of funding. Secondly, while asset-backed issuance was most disrupted by the crisis, I think there are reasonable signs of a re-emergence in that market, particularly in the early part of this year. And thirdly, investors have a much stronger preference for higher quality assets than they did in the pre-crisis period, and SSAs are certainly a beneficiary of that. So let me finish there, and I'm happy to take some questions from the floor.
Matt Barron, TD Securities. You referred to depth of local market trading and demonstrated liquidity in times of stress when you were talking about the SSA space specifically. Yep. What measures were used to measure that form of liquidity and the amount of turnover that was generated during that period of stress that the RBA looked at to determine if those securities would provide adequate liquidity?
We looked at the turnover in those securities. The other thing we look at is how much. One thing we look at is how much. If I come to you and say, "Can I sell 20 mil of that line?" Are you going to say yes or no at the current price? Part of it's the amount of turnover, the size of a packet that people can actually sell, and the bid ask that is available that was there on those securities. So, it's across a range of indicators, basically.
Mr. DeBell, it's Kai Chow from Sky News Business, just up the back here. You mentioned that we've recently endured some of these stressed market conditions. Mm-hmm. I know you can't talk about the macroeconomic outlook, but the impact of something like Japan, was that what you were referring to, or is that something that...
No, we're talking about financially, the stress in financial markets. So we're looking at basically what financial instruments remain liquid during stressed financial conditions, or the various degrees of liquidity. So the banks have to hold these assets to be liquid, so that they can be able to access liquidity in stress conditions. So, that's the purpose of the liquidity facility, of the liquidity regulations. So it's how these different asset classes performed in those various stress conditions gives us some idea about what their liquidity characteristics are.
Can something like what happened in Japan impact, though, those market conditions?
Market conditions aren't particularly stressed at the moment, so... Financial market conditions, are not particularly stressed at the moment. I'm talking about the sort of financial stresses that we saw over the last few years.
Peter Panetta, Investec Bank. If your conclusion is that the changes to the liquidity rules and the implementation of the RBA facility aren't going to fundamentally change the makeup of bank liquidity portfolios, mm-hmm. are those regulatory rules then having their intended effect of improving the quality of liquidity buffers?
Well, the banks, they're going to have to hold more. So, the implications of the new liquidity regime is that the banks' liquidity books are going to be larger. In other jurisdictions, basically, the requirement is you have to hold government paper. So that's the main impact of the new liquidity regulation. We don't have enough government paper. We're a hell of a long way short of it, sort of 30 or 40% of GDP short of it, at least. So, therefore, we weren't able to meet that requirement through just holdings of government paper. Hence, in the Basel liquidity, the liquidity rules coming out of Basel, there is this clause which says that in markets where there isn't enough government paper, then alternative arrangements can be put in place, and the alternative arrangements that have been put in place by APRA in consultation with ourselves is access to liquidity through the RBA.
Guy, it's Tom Irving from TD Securities. Just a question on the timing for the facility and the fees that are going to be put in place.
Yeah.
Is there any more clarity on that, or is sort of 2011, 2012 general sort of timing expected?
Broadly in that time frame. Let me tell you, which we've put out in our press release, give you some guidance as to what sort of considerations are going into the fee, and then give you some idea. As I said, it's a flat fee, it's a positive number, and it's probably not particularly high. It's not going to be punitive. Basically, we've got in other markets, banks are having to meet this liquidity requirement by holding government paper. Here, you're allowed to, banks will basically be able to hold roughly. There will be some requirement that they hold some government paper, but beyond that, their asset holding is going to be broadly the same as what they are at the moment. So if you compare what's happening here with what's happening in other jurisdictions, banks are going to be holding much higher yielding assets on their balance sheet, which obviously is nice for them, compared to other jurisdictions they're going to be forced to hold much lower yielding government assets. So part of the point of the... Now, part of that increased spread reflects credit, which you should be compensated for, but part of it also reflects liquidity. And so the aim of the fee is to try and extract the component of the spread between the private sector securities and the government securities, which reflects a liquidity premium, particularly in stress conditions. So we can look at the spread between those two asset classes over a period of time, including a stress period of time, and get some idea of what the average liquidity premium is, and the fee is going to be aimed to broadly replicate that. That will probably be, there'll be more information forthcoming on that over the rest of this year and maybe into next year. But
and just sorry, just one more. Were you surprised by the market reaction to the announcement from APRA?
No, not particularly. Arguably, you can see. If anything, I think it validated the conclusion in the sense that there was a shift in the price and no trading occurred, which seems to me to partly indicate the market wasn't completely liquid. But that said, there was a big movement on the announcement and then it mostly came back. The rise in spread, 7-8 basis points, seemed to be mostly retraced within sort of 48 hours, certainly.
Hi, it's Mark Goddard from Westpac. One question I've been asked by a couple of issuers, going back to Matt's question about the measures that you use in terms of testing liquidity, a number of issuers themselves keep a lot of turnover data. They weren't asked for information, I think, is a comment that a couple of them have made. Can you expand further on where you got
some instruments from? We're in the market ourselves, so we have access to the turnover data. So is it the case, a number of the issuers have said, well, I'm more liquid than Tassie paper. So a number of those super issues. This is probably true. But if you talk to most participants in the market, they will hedge their smaller semi-holdings with large semi-holdings. They don't do that with their super issuance. So basically, the semis are we can treat semis broadly as one asset class in toto. So while there is a clear... I don't think it should have come as any particular surprise in the market to be the conclusion that semis are a hell of a lot more liquid than supras. I don't think that's really in dispute. You can pick out some of the smaller semis and say, yeah, they're a bit less liquid than some of the larger supras. That's probably true. But semis as a whole are markedly more liquid than supras, and that was certainly true through sort of 08 and 09. So, as I said, I mean, as APRA said, though, it's not, you know, this is not the, you know, where the what's included in the liquidity, what's included in sort of the level one or level two assets will be continually assessed through time. So it's not a once and for all decision. But the other point I was trying to make at the end there is that, okay, so supers aren't classified as level one assets. They're still eligible for repo with us, which means banks are still going to hold them in their liquidity books and under the new regime will still be, I would have thought, holding them in their liquidity books to meet the, you know, to meet the, to access the facility with us. So it's not that supers have somehow or another been disadvantaged relative to other asset classes. It's, I mean, our CGS and semis slightly elevated status as a level one asset? Yeah, that's right. But it's not like supers have been somehow grossly disadvantaged here.
Sean Sir from Royal Bank of Canada. Where do you see, it's a market you mentioned very quickly before, where do you see the cover bond market going forward and what expectations do you have in terms of volume there?
As I said earlier, I mean, I'm not sure. If you talk to investors in Australia who are fairly comfortable with the RMBS product, I'm not sure there's going to be necessarily a large demand from the domestic investor base for covered bonds. I mean, I'm sure there'll be some portfolios which will have an interest in it. I mean, it seems to me the main appetite for covered issuance is going to be offshore, obviously in Europe where they're particularly familiar with covered issuance. And I mean, there's been a hell of a lot of covered issuance so far in Europe this year, and there are a reasonable number of reports that investors are getting a little full of it, but they may well be looking for exposure to another market outside Europe, and in which case Aussie covered issuance may be somewhat attractive. So my guess is that you'd probably like to see more of that issuance offshore rather than onshore, where the investors are probably going to be more comfortable with the MBS product. That's purely a guess.